From NPR and WBUR, I'm Don Gagne.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Pfizer failed to make the case for a booster dose of its COVID-19 vaccine at a key meeting of government health experts yesterday. President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was among the health officials in that meeting with the pharmaceutical company. And it comes as the seven-day average of cases in the U.S. has risen above 19,000. That's an increase of nearly 50% from the week before, according to Johns Hopkins University. A majority of those cases coming from just five states: Florida, Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, and Nevada. Let's bring in Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's on Skype. Doctor, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And let's start with this dramatic increase in cases over the last week. How concerned are you that we're headed toward another surge?
Well, I'm concerned not about a broad general surge throughout the country, because I have said this several times before over the past few weeks. We have places in the country, regions that you mentioned in your introduction, that are having about 50% of all the new infections. And it's very closely related to those places, states, cities, counties, that have a very low level of vaccination. The reason that that occurs, obviously, is that we know the vaccines are highly protective against the virus, including the Delta variant of the virus. But in those areas of the country where the vaccination level is low, somewhere around 30%, they are the most vulnerable. So my concern for the unvaccinated people: if you are vaccinated, you have a high degree of protection. If you're not, you're really quite at risk. So that's my concern, because we still have a considerable number of people who are not vaccinated yet in this country.
Well, and across the country, the rate of vaccination here is down 84% from its peak in April. So what is the consequence, the real-life consequence, of not increasing that pace of vaccines?
Well, the real-life consequence is obvious. When you have a vaccine that's highly protective and you get people who don't get vaccinated, you're going to continue to see a level of infection. If you look at the curve for our own country, after that very, very sharp spike that we saw at the fall and winter and into the late part of the winter, that then went down as we began to implement vaccination programs. And the number of infections went way down, really quite low. It went from like 70,000 a day to 60 to 50 to 40 to 30, way down. But then what happened is that we're having now an increasing dominance of the Delta variant, which has a much greater capability of spreading from person to person. So as we get this dominance of this highly transmissible variant, when you get a fragment of the people, a proportion of the people who are not vaccinated, then you're going to start seeing a turnaround. And that's exactly what we're seeing. It's entirely predictable. If you don't get people vaccinated and you have a variant that has a high degree of capability of transmitting from person to person, you're going to see a diminution in the decline and an increase in the incline of cases, which unfortunately, as you said correctly, that's exactly what's happening.
Well, let's talk more about Pfizer's request for a booster dose. You have said that it was not needed yet. Did you hear anything at yesterday's meeting with Pfizer that changed your opinion?
Well, the Pfizer data, but first of all, people need to understand that that meeting was not by any means a decisional meeting. It was a courtesy meeting on the part of Pfizer when they made their announcement a few days before about data that they had, partly from Israel and partly from their own study, that I called them up and said, you know, it would be a good idea if we were able to sit down with you over a Zoom call and take a look at the data. And that's exactly what happened. But I think people need to understand that, as important as the data may ultimately be, it's still a relatively small part of a much larger puzzle or framework of data, including the CDC that has over 20 cohorts that they're following. So it isn't like there's no chance that they're going to be a booster, but a decision about whether or not a booster is going to be given or when has not been made. But the CDC and the FDA are working very hard to get as much data as they possibly can to adequately address that question.
And I wonder what you make of Israel's decision. It is starting a Pfizer booster for the most severely immunocompromised people there, transplant patients, cancer patients, that sort of thing. Is that an approach that you would be open to considering here?
Well, we keep our minds open to any approach. You always have to keep an open mind when you have a fluid situation like this. I mean, that has to be the characteristic of what you do when you're dealing with public health measures. Israel made that decision. I'm not going to argue with that decision. It's not an unreasonable decision. But remember, if you look at the big picture of the global response to this outbreak, the global response to COVID-19, you have to think carefully about giving a third shot to people to prevent asymptomatic infection when most of the world has not received their first shot that might protect them against serious consequences and death. That's something that you really need to be thinking about carefully.
Anthony Fauci, I want to ask you just briefly about Johnson & Johnson news that about 100 cases of the neurological disorder Guillain-Barré have been potentially linked to it out of 13 million doses. It's very rare, but is it a blow to vaccine confidence in general? Briefly, please.
I wouldn't say it's a blow. I think it's something that inevitably happens. You get adverse events. You put it into the perspective. Is the vaccine benefit well worth the risk of a very rare adverse event? And generally, we've seen with these vaccines, certainly the COVID-19, that it always comes out that the benefit of the vaccine itself to protect against the disease outweighs any small risk of an adverse event.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
It's only July, but we need to talk about wildfires. More than 2 million acres have burned so far this year. It's a big increase compared to this time last year. The largest of the fires is in South Central Oregon. The so-called bootleg fire started a week ago. So far, it's destroyed several homes in Klamath County and also damaged a major power transmission corridor that provides electricity to California. Joining us now for the latest is Eric Newman, a reporter with member station Jefferson Public Radio. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Tell us more about the geography, where this fire is burning, and why it's so challenging for firefighters to get a handle on it.
It's burning right north of the California-Oregon border in Klamath County, like you mentioned. It's a large rural area of forest and high desert. There's miscellaneous small communities that are sort of out in the woods in this area. And the real challenge for firefighters is the dryness and the weather conditions that have been creating extreme fire behavior. Basically, there's just bone dry conditions because we've been in this drought out here in Southern Oregon. Firefighters, I was out at the fire camp yesterday, and they just described it like September conditions in a drought year, except we're in July. So the trees and the grasses are extremely dry. Over the weekend, firefighters had to retreat from the fire for safety. So it's just a very challenging situation.
And as we said, some homes were destroyed, but I also wonder how serious the damage is to the power transmission corridor that connects Oregon and California.
Yeah, as of yesterday, so there's these huge power lines that go from Oregon to California, bringing power to California. As of yesterday, folks from the utilities were inspecting the power lines to find out what sort of damage there was. They were de-energized over the weekend out of the concern as the fire burned across them that they could damage the power lines. But as of yesterday, they didn't have information specifically about what that damage was. When they de-energized them, that's what created the flex alerts in California warning about, you know, encouraging people to conserve power because there would just be less available. We should know, I would assume, in the coming days if there was real damage. But right now, I don't have much information about that.
We spoke to you last fall when another fire leveled two towns, Talent, Oregon, and Phoenix, Oregon. The criticism back then was that people didn't get notified about evacuations. What about this time?
There hasn't been criticism about evacuations so far. I think everyone is just really nervous about this wildfire season. So there's a lot of proactive messaging that's been going out. Again, these are also fairly rural communities out in the woods. So whereas last year, the Alameda fire burned really through a few towns and there was a lot of people that were affected. This is a smaller population in the woods. So just having spoken with deputies from the sheriff's department, they've been out knocking on people's doors, getting them to leave, although there have been some challenges with actually getting people to get away from their houses and leave their livestock and that kind of thing.
Eric Newman is a reporter with Jefferson Public Radio in Oregon. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
The United States should mandate vaccines and vaccine passports. That's the argument historian Julian Zelizer makes in a recent column for CNN. He says that the Delta variant is a strong reminder that while it may seem like the pandemic is fading in some parts of the country, it hasn't ended and is really affecting unvaccinated populations. Getting them vaccinated, he argues, is key to a future where the coronavirus is not a threat. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He joins us now. Greetings.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Julian, sketch it out for us. You say vaccines should be mandated. Make that argument.
Yeah, look, this is a healthcare crisis unlike any we have lived through. Recently, the physical, economic, and psychological cost is enormous, and the vaccines are proving very effective. So, first, we can have schools, healthcare institutions, businesses require their employees to have a vaccine. There's precedent for this. Public schools have been doing this since the 19th century. And we can have some sort, secondly, of vaccine passport, which is a proof of vaccination for consumers, whether they're going to eat in a restaurant or go to a concert. And we need to do more of this because relying on individual choice is not getting us to the rates that we need to finally curb this disease.
Aren't we maybe past the point where we might have been able to take this step? Given all the political controversy and political divisions over vaccines and the pandemic in general, it's hard to see a way to walk that back.
Well, that's a very fair point. I don't have an answer to that. And what has been remarkable is the way in which anti-vaccination rhetoric has been deployed by Republican officials and a lot of the conservative media. And that makes it very hard. I think the only antidote to that, so to speak, is the lived experience of individuals who are experiencing some kind of normal compared to areas where there is not much vaccination, and we see exactly what's happening there. So that's the only way to counteract what's coming from the political sphere.
Do you acknowledge there are some legitimate reasons for certain individuals to not get vaccinated, maybe health reasons or religion, and how would you deal with those?
Of course. And we've dealt with this before. I mean, again, mandating certain kind of vaccines is not new in the United States. And there's always room for exemptions, whether it's for medical reasons or for religious reasons. You don't need 100% vaccination. You're just trying to get a lot closer to that so that you contain the disease than where we are right now.
You say both political parties made a mistake in the way they frame the pandemic. How so?
Yeah, it's all about individual choice. I do think many Republicans are talking about a defense of liberty and defense from government. But many Democrats and liberals are also focused on individual choice and creating incentives for people to make the right decision. But sometimes the common good matters as much, if not more, than individual choice. And that's where discussions of mandates become much more important and logical when we think of the collective rather than the individual.
It is that debate, individual choice versus the common good. Compare this to times in the past when Americans have been asked to put the common good over their own individual needs.
We've done it many times during World War II in the fight against fascism. People were asked to serve in the army. They were asked to pay taxes to fight for the military. We have a Social Security program, which requires individuals to pay to support our elderly Americans. And again, we have vaccines in schools to combat things like measles that are asking individuals to participate in something bigger. So this is part of the American experience.
Just quickly going forward, you expect this to be a political kind of hot button issue going forward in the midterms and presidential elections?
Absolutely. I think since this is the path to solving the problem we have faced for over a year, and it's also a very politicized issue now, I think politicians are going to be talking a lot about this in the coming months.
All right. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Lake Michigan will soon have its first national marine sanctuary, and it's teeming with shipwrecks. Last month, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration designated a stretch of water between Milwaukee and Green Bay as the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary. Good name for it because it contains the remains of 36 known shipwrecks and potentially 59 more that have yet to be explored. Kevin Cullen is president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I bet a lot of people are surprised to learn that there are so many shipwrecks off the coast of Wisconsin.
Right. So we are, of course, one of the five Great Lakes. And it's that reason, you know, cities like Chicago, Milwaukee, Sheboygan, Manitowoc, Green Bay are where they are is because of this maritime highway. And so it's no surprise then that the number of shipwrecks, schooners, lumber schooners, to all the way to major steel-hulled railroad car ferries that were carrying automobiles. In fact, even going back to the fur trade, it's a broad range, and many of them are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And so this designation, this NOAA sanctuary, adds another layer of protection and accessibility and notoriety to these world-class shipwrecks.
So you've been diving in Lake Michigan for many years. Describe it to us. I mean, what is it like at the bottom of the lake when you're in front of these shipwrecks?
There truly is nothing like it. Of course, you're feeling the cold temperature and the pressure of the water column around you as you go down, especially when you pass the second thermocline, when it drops to 40 degrees or so, when the surface temperature may be around 70. You're truly vulnerable, but then you behold this hulk of a monstrosity, depending on the preservation of the particular ship. But in some way, some of them are graveyards. They carry and have carried humans on them that perished in pretty harrowing circumstances.
Can you feel the enormity of what happened there all those years later?
Absolutely. So, you know, some of the vessels, you know, they may have pretty rudimentary stories that they were carrying lumber. You know, for instance, the Rouse Simmons, the Christmas tree ship. She was a well-known Great Lakes schooner, one of the eldest of her age when she went down in 1912, built in 1868. She was on her way to Chicago carrying Christmas trees when a terrible storm, as they often occur, she ended up going down with all lives, 16 of them, some of them lumberjacks. That was the Christmas in Chicago that Christmas trees didn't arrive, where it was a tradition to go down to the wharf and select your tree. And so to this day, that vessel still is sitting. This is on the very northern fringe of the new proposed sanctuary, and it still has Christmas trees in her hold. So not only did they have these, you know, truly sad stories, but they provide information for us to then recreate and relive what it was like to be on a 19th century schooner here in the 21st century.
Wow. What is the state of these shipwrecks? How well preserved are they?
The preservation really depends on the circumstance in which the ship went down. If it was a storm and kind of capsized, then it's essentially a shipwreck in a bottle preservation where the masts are still upright. Truly, they range from, you know, the metal Senator, if that went down in 500 feet of water, depending on the impact, you know, with a 400-foot-long hull, it will crumple the metal. But for the most part, it settles down, and it's just like you would find it. You know, there has been vessels found in Wisconsin over the years that they literally pumped them out. I know this happened in the Bay of Green Bay, and they were able to raise it up. They pumped out the water and it sailed away. They were able to float it. And it was a wreck from the Civil War period. So,
oh, wow. That water's cold, right? I mean, is that why?
Yeah. So cold, fresh water, exactly, is kind of the pristine environment for the, especially wood preservation. If this was salt water, the salt actually and the marine worms that are bore into the wood actually cause the wood to decay. So you only are left with some of the metal and maybe some of the ballast stone or some of those artifacts. You get the outline of them. But here you have the entire vessel. And some of these are over 200 years old now, the oldest going back or coming up on 200 years.
But is it true that many of the shipwrecks in this sanctuary are still unexplored? No one's ever been down there.
Truly, yes. I mean, in fact, even last year, there was one just discovered using sonar technology. It's over 400 feet deep, and that's the Pier Marquette 18. That's been on our radar for a while now, and a couple of colleagues were successful in doing the true research of finding, you know, where the newspaper accounts were and lining up maps and nautical charts and then doing the hard work of being out there, and we call it mowing the lawn. It's using sonar and boat patterns, and you basically go back and forth until a target is reached. In order to confirm that, though, what they were able to do and had to do is drop camera or an ROV, a remotely operated vehicle, down. But because it's so deep, it's really outside of the range of even technical divers. This is the other really, I think, exciting thing that NOAA will be able to bring in. New technologies that can access these wrecks in much more efficient ways, and maybe even subs in the future, you know, bringing humans down to these depths that we can't actually access with regular scuba gear.
Kevin Cullen, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association, thanks for taking us on this little journey underneath Lake Michigan. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The economy is changing so fast right now, and sometimes it seems like there's something new to worry about every day. On The Indicator from Planet Money, we bring you human stories and easy-to-understand explanations to help you make sense of these crazy times, all in just 10 minutes a day. That's The Indicator from Planet Money.
In Iraq, the death toll from a fire that erupted in the coronavirus ward of a hospital last night has risen above 90. Iraqi medical officials say dozens more were injured. NPR's Ruth Sherlock joins us now from Beirut. What do we know so far about this fire?
Well, this fire broke out in a building for COVID-19 patients at the Al Hussein Teaching Hospital in Nasiriya, a city in southern Iraq, on Monday night. You know, the videos from the scene are just terrifying. You've got these firefighters and onlookers all silhouetted in the light of these huge flames that have engulfed the whole ward. Eyewitnesses say that as the fire took hold, it blocked the exits, meaning that people had no way to escape. We reached Mohsen Sabr Obaid, who works at the Health Directorate in the city, and he was also an eyewitness to the fire because his house is nearby, and when he heard what was happening, he thought he'd run down and try to help. He tells us what he saw. So he says he and others were trying to save people, but they found that the fire was just too intense. He says there was nothing we could do besides hear the screams from people inside the center. I felt helpless. It's not known exactly what caused the fire. Early on, officials told the Associated Press that it could have been caused by an electrical short circuit, but they've given no evidence for that. The health directorate in the province says that the fire may have been caused by an oxygen cylinder exploding.
I mean, it's almost incomprehensible. This is the second time a COVID ward in Iraq has caught fire in 3 months, right?
That's right. You know, last April, in a coronavirus ward at a hospital in Baghdad, 82 people died. And that fire was, again, said to have been caused by a faulty oxygen tank. The prime minister at the time fired a lot of top officials, including the health minister, and ordered an investigation. But what today's fire shows is that it seems that these key issues still haven't been resolved.
I can only imagine the anger that both of these fires have resulted in. What kind of reaction are you getting to this latest fire?
Yeah, anger and tragedy. So local officials have called for a period of mourning. The Prime Minister, Mustafa Al-Kadhimi, has ordered another full investigation into the causes. He also ordered the suspension and arrest of the health directors of Dikar, that's the province of the Al-Hussein Hospital, as well as the director of the civil defence there. But, you know, so far that's done little to quell people's anger. Last night, locals and relatives of the dead clashed with police. And, you know, it's not lost on politicians that this fire in the city of Nasiriyah comes on the back of major popular anger there. And there's been fury at government dysfunction. People have been taking to the streets to protest chronic government corruption that experts say has led to essentially the destruction of services in Iraq and a very, very weak healthcare system.
Well, that leads to the question, what does this say about Iraq's healthcare system and how it has responded to the pandemic?
Well, so we know that hospitals are underfunded with lacking in medicines and equipment, and that's been a real problem in this pandemic. The Iraq has struggled to cope. You know, COVID-19 has now killed more than 17,000, approximately 17,600 people and infected more than 1.4 million people in the country, according to Johns Hopkins. They're going through another wave now, but only a tiny percentage of the population, I think about 1%, have been fully vaccinated so far.
That's NPR's Ruth Sherlock. Ruth, thank you.
Thank you very much.
College sports will return to normal this fall, and summer recruiting is already in full swing. But this year, athletic departments may be feeling more pressure to court top athletes. That's because last month, the Supreme Court said the NCAA cannot limit educational benefits like grad school tuition or computers that colleges use to attract top athletes. Those benefits are expensive, and our next guest thinks the court's decision will ultimately make it harder for low-income students to go to college. Let's bring in Angel Perez. He's the CEO of the National Association for College Admissions Counseling, who's written an article in The Atlantic about his prediction. Angel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And you write that the Supreme Court's decision and the move subsequently to allow for compensation for name, image, and likeness will create greater equity for some schools and some students. Why only some?
I think a big part of the reason why it's only some is because the actual athletes certainly will benefit, and this ruling is a long time coming. But the reality of the matter is most schools, especially after the pandemic, have really been stretched financially. And so if they are now going to incentivize athletes in order to attract athletes to their campuses, it could become really a financial trade-off that could disadvantage some of the lower income students.
On the other end of the spectrum, there's the big schools, the powerhouse athletic conferences that can actually raise a lot of money. How do you think they'll pass on those costs of these new benefits to athletes?
Well, I think it's important to note that those schools are actually in the minority of the over 1,000-plus members of NCAA schools. But those schools are actually going to be okay because they probably will be passing on the cost to the private sector through television and other sponsorship contracts.
And the smaller schools, how will they do it?
The smaller schools really are going to have to make some trade-off decisions. And so there are schools that may have to think about perhaps providing less financial aid for some students in order to incentivize their athletes, or perhaps they're going to take resources from their student support services budgets because they certainly won't have the resources to be able to do it all.
Why would they do that? Why would they make cuts to their educational programs and not cuts to the athletic department?
I think it's important for people to know that, first of all, college athletics is really important in the United States and particularly in American higher education. But a lot of colleges and universities use their athletic programs to recruit and retain students. And the other piece is that there's a lot of pride in the United States with collegiate athletics. And so if college programs do well, a lot of their alums will also donate to the institution. So there is a financial investment here as well.
So what's the bottom line? If these smaller schools without the financial resources as the big ones, what if they do start making cuts like this, making these trade-offs as you describe them? What's the result for students?
Well, I think the result could be that some of the students that were intended to be supported in this ruling, low-income students, students of color, actually may become disadvantaged as a result of this. So, for example, if a small school is going to cut their financial aid budget because they need to provide more resources for incoming athletes, that means fewer students who need the financial aid resources to get into the institutions will actually be admitted. So, in the end, it could end up hurting disadvantaged populations.
It's complicated, though, isn't it? Because some have also made the argument that low-income students, and especially athletes, you know, they're the ones who are bearing the brunt of the system as it has been for so many years, that they have traditionally not profited off of their talents, while the universities have made a fortune. And that, too, is unfair.
That is absolutely unfair. And you're right. That's exactly why it's complicated. But I think also part of the thing we need to think about is how many students are actually benefiting from these new incentives and how many students might be left out as a result of them.
Mm. So if the Supreme Court decision creates more problems or new problems in your mind, how do we solve it? How do we get back to equity in higher education?
I think a big part of this is colleges and universities need to take a moment to pause and really remember what is the purpose of our education, and also what are the financial commitments that we are willing to make. College presidents, boards of trustees really should be thinking about where they want to put their resources and whether or not some of their athletic programming is worth the actual cost. And again, what are the trade-offs?
Are you suggesting that maybe some of those programs in the athletic department should be cut, even though there will be tremendous pressure not to do so?
I worked in higher education for 22 years, and so I know about the tremendous pressure that athletic programs face, and especially if college presidents even suggest that they might cut some of those programs, especially because it's tied directly to potential fundraising efforts. But I do think it's important for colleges to pause and ask themselves about each of their programs. What is the return on the investment? What is the return on the student experience? And then decide whether or not those programs are actually worth keeping.
Angel Perez is CEO of the National Association for College Admission Counseling. We'll link you to his article in the Atlantic at hereandnow.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
In Arizona, COVID-19 vaccination rates for Latinos are only about half of what they are for white residents. Civil rights advocates say one reason is the state hasn't moved quickly enough to provide vaccine information in Spanish. Angela Gervasi with member station KNAU and Flagstaff reports.
Kristen Urquiza grew up in Maryvale. It's in Phoenix, but she describes it as a little New York.
On my mom's street, we have folks from El Salvador, people on the right-hand side that are from Mexico.
The pandemic hit Maryvale hard. Urquiza's father died from the virus last summer. In one Maryvale zip code, a little over a third of the population has been vaccinated. A half-hour drive away, in the wealthier, whiter suburb of Sun City West, it's more than 81%. Urquiza runs the nonprofit Marked by COVID, which is affiliated with the Democratic fundraising platform Act Blue.
I don't think we did what we needed to do to ensure that that basic information was available in a language that was accessible to the people who were most in harm's way.
There is Spanish language information about the pandemic in Arizona, but it's been slow to roll out. The state health department didn't offer online vaccine registration in Spanish until February, 2 months after registration started. The department says it was a configuration issue. In those early months, the state established large-scale vaccination sites in stadiums and arenas, but critics say they weren't accessible to all Spanish-speaking communities. People had trouble getting time off work, for example. Dr. Kara Crist is the director of the Department of Health Services.
Our mass vaccination sites were really only one part of the strategy. We always were looking to do community-based vaccination sites.
She says the state has partnered with local groups to launch those sites. But she adds,
Arizona is a decentralized public health system. And so the counties really are responsible for the vaccination efforts in their areas.
2 hours north of Phoenix in Flagstaff, the county health department held a clinic with a local church and an interfaith organization. Here, there's a medical interpreter and Spanish-speaking volunteers like Nelly Navarro.
En todo esto, la clave es la información, ¿verdad?
Navarro says information is key. She had her own doubts before getting the shot. Now she's glad she did. She feels safe hugging her mother again.
Para mí, recibir la vacuna es como esa seguridad de que ya puedo abrazar a mi mamá.
Lydia Guzman says holding clinics at familiar spaces can help eliminate distrust or fear. She's with Chicanos por la Causa, a social justice nonprofit. She says it's also crucial to allow local leaders to encourage the vaccine.
The faith leaders, the teachers, the local doctors, the state, they're doing a lot. Could they have done more? I would say that they could have done more, but sooner. The fact that we're playing catch-up is sad.
Lately, the state health department has targeted certain communities with cell phone alerts, inviting people to a Spanish-language town hall about vaccination. Guzman says it's a good idea for a demographic that tends to utilize texting and WhatsApp.
If you can get a message in, just like the Amber Alert or something like that, into your phone, this is a great way to give and deliver a message to a hard-to-reach population.
Other activists agree it's a useful tactic, but think the state needs to use it more frequently, saying the messages need to be repeated to be effective. That's not a problem in some Arizona counties like Santa Cruz, where Spanish is more widely spoken. Many healthcare workers here are bilingual, and it has among the state's highest vaccination rates. For NPR News, I'm Angela Gervasi in Flagstaff.
On Colorado's southern border, about 200 miles south of Denver, lies the city of Trinidad. There's been a boom and bust economic cycle in Trinidad for a very long time, since its founding as a coal mining town in the 1860s. But now a growing number of entertainers and entrepreneurs are leaving Denver and are flocking to Trinidad. They're hoping to build a more stable economy there, rooted in arts and culture. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports.
Outside of the Trinidad Lounge on the edge of downtown, an old man who calls himself the Blind Man of God plays guitar and sings for pedestrians in the early evening. He's wearing a ball cap covered with depictions of pot leaves.
I know what's going to happen here. I know this town is marked by the hand of God, brother.
Theron Sandy followed his son here a couple years ago from North Carolina. He says he's had dreams that in Trinidad, God will restore the sight he lost as a teenager. Now, inside the Trinidad Lounge, co-owner Suzanne Magnuson prepares for the night's onstage musical act, a country band stopping on the way up to Denver.
I've always thought of a good bar as like a character in the story. And this is a character in the story of Trinidad, and we're just here to kind of bring it back to life.
The lounge had been shuttered for almost a decade when she bought the place last year with her husband, Kurt Wallach. They also own an alternative music venue in Denver called The High Dive. Wallach says he wants the lounge in Trinidad to have the sort of local impact he believes The High Dive used to have in Denver.
Those places can't touch the cultural fabric anymore. The cultural fabric of the city has gone beyond that. And I feel like that Denver outgrew us in some ways.
Now this is Trinidad, Colorado's number one, most important, most viewed.
A few blocks from the Trinidad Lounge, you'll find comedian Jay Gillespie standing in a vacant storefront in front of a green screen talking to a webcam.
Now welcome to the stream, everyone.
It's an improvised nightly video stream he calls Cougar Nights Live. Gillespie spent 8 years working the Denver stand-up scene. Then he took his act on the road.
And I've sort of toured all over, and at the end of the day, anything is as good as anywhere else. You can live in L.A., bang your head against the wall, live in Denver, hit five mics a night. I live in Trinidad, and currently I'm getting the most sort of interest in what I'm doing that I've ever had.
Gaining traction with an online audience, yeah, that's part of it. Though, as a bigger fish in a smaller pond, he says what he's doing, it's noticed here. He's visible.
And so everyone's like, oh yeah, that's Jay Gillespie. He's our comedian.
Denver entrepreneur and one-time mayoral candidate Kayvon Collet-Barry owns that vacant storefront Gillespie tells jokes in. Collet-Barry's making a big financial bet on Trinidad, that smaller towns are seeing a renaissance, spurred on by the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, people taking flight from urban areas and setting up shop in these places where, you know, they're safer, they have good schools, they have cheaper home prices, cheaper cost of living.
He has spent millions in the last year, buying a dozen properties in and around Trinidad's historic downtown. A Denver coffee shop, a Denver pizza place, a Denver brewery, they will all be opening new Trinidad locations in his buildings within the next year. Two blocks west of Gillespie's comedy show, you'll find the guy facilitating a lot of this investment.
My name is Wally Wallace, and I am the Economic Development Director for the city of Trinidad, Colorado.
For years, Wallace was involved as an event organizer in Denver, largely in the comedy scene, friends with Jay Gillespie and Kayvon Kalitbari. At the beginning of 2019, he started this new gig in Trinidad.
I've just made it a point to put that out to the rest of the world that I'm not stuck in traffic. Hey, I'm paying one half of what I was paying for my house here, and I'm not renting it. I own it. I'm building equity here.
He says more than 20 of his friends have packed up and moved here in the last year or two, many from Denver's art scene, including those new owners of the Trinidad Lounge back down the street, Kurt Wallach and Suzanne Magnuson.
I'm hoping that as we grow down here that we can do it in a way that's like consciously done so that we still have affordable housing. I don't want it to spiral out of control that like everything's an Airbnb and there's nowhere that families can live.
It's the classic challenge faced by so many Colorado mountain towns. Word gets out, new money comes in, locals get pushed out. Economic Development Director Wally Wallace says his biggest obstacle right now is trying to avoid that future. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.